Okay, I want to start today with a number that I actually had to circle three times in the briefing material just to make sure I was reading it right. 50%?
It is a staggering number.
It really is.
Yeah.
According to the CDC data, we're looking at nearly half of all children with autism spectrum disorder attempt to wander or run off from a safe environment.
Yeah.
And we aren't talking about a kid just, lingering in the toy aisle at the grocery store.
No, and that's a crucial distinction right out of the gate. We're talking about a significant safety threat.
A huge one.
The data shows that when these kids lead a safe environment, they aren't just lost in the way we might think. They are at a disproportionately high risk of injury, trauma, and sadly, death.
And that's what keeps parents up at night. There was one statistic in the research that just it put a pit in my stomach, the drowning risk.
It's heartbreaking, but we have to face it. The source material shows that autistic children are 160 times more likely to drown than their neurotypical peers.
160 times. That's not a margin of error. That's a completely different reality.
It's a terrifying multiplier. And they also face high risks from traffic, from exposure to extreme weather. They might not even realize they're cold or overheating.
Right.
And unfortunately, the risk of encounters with strangers when they end up in unfamiliar territory.
So the mission for this deep dive is pretty clear. We need to move past the fear, which is valid, but it can be paralyzing, and get to the practical stuff. You need to unpack autistic elopement. We need to understand not just that it happens, but why it happens, the psychology behind it, and then get into the really granular practical strategies for prevention.
At home and at school. And honestly, the why is the most important part. If you don't get the why, you can't really solve the problem.
Okay, so before we get to the why, we have to get the terminology right. The sources bounce between two words, wandering and elopement. Are they just synonyms?
Well, they're often used interchangeably in casual conversation, but in the context of safety and psychology, there is a distinct difference. Think of wandering as something aimless. We see it a lot in dementia care. A person walks out the door, but there isn't really a destination. They're confused, maybe a bit
So
disoriented.
wandering is adrift. It's almost semi-conscious.
Exactly. Elopement, on the other hand, is a mission.
A mission.
Yes. When an autistic child elopes, it is almost always goal-directed. They are either running towards something they desperately want
Or running away from something.
or running away from something that feels unbearable.
That distinction seems massive for prevention. Because if it's a mission, that means there's a trigger, there's a logic to it.
Precisely. And that's the biggest misconception we need to clear up. Elopement isn't usually bad behavior. It's not a child thinking, I'm going to be naughty to make my parents mad.
Right.
It's a form of communication. It's a child saying, I have a need that isn't being met, or I am in distress, and they are using their feet to solve the problem.
The sources also mentioned that while this risk exists everywhere, it isn't spread evenly across the spectrum.
Right. It can happen with any autistic child, verbal or not. But the data shows the incidence rate climbs with the support level. So a child with level 3 autism is statistically more likely to attempt elopement than a child with level 1.
Okay, let's get inside their headspace.
Yeah.
If elopement is a mission, what is the mission usually about? The research outlines five main triggers.
The first one is fascinating because it's actually rooted in something positive. An attraction to specific places. This ties into the whole idea of special interests.
Like the obsession some kids have with trains or elevators.
Exactly. But for elopement, the big one, the dangerous one, is water. And this explains that drowning statistic we mentioned.
So what is it about water?
For a lot of autistic kids, a pool isn't just a pool, it's a sensory magnet. It's the way the light shimmers on it, it's the sound of the splash.
Okay.
And if they get in, it's the feeling of weightlessness. That pressure can be incredibly regulating for a sensory system that feels overloaded.
So they aren't seeing danger, they're seeing peace.
Or they're seeing glitter, they get tunnel vision. The drive to get to that sensory experience is so powerful, it overrides any safety rules they've been taught. They don't see the fence, they just see the water.
Wow. And the same for train tracks.
Same thing. The rhythmic movement can be visually stimulating in a way that just pulls them in. It's terrifying, but it's a dopamine pursuit.
It is, which leads right into the second trigger, movement and curiosity. All kids are curious.
Of course, but with autism, you often have this combination of a high drive for exploration and a significantly reduced danger filter.
So they want to see what's over the hill, but they don't calculate that crossing the street to get there is risky.
Right, or they just have a physiological need to run to feel the wind If the door is open, that's an invitation. It's not, I'm leaving home. It's, I'm going that way.
Now, the third trigger listed was difficulty with transitions. This feels like a big one for the school setting.
It's huge. It's something educators really need to understand. We know that autistic brains often struggle with set shifting, stopping one task and starting another. It's sometimes called autistic inertia.
Inertia? Like in physics, an object in motion stays in motion.
That's it exactly.
Yeah.
If a child is deep in a flow state building with Legos, maybe, and a teacher says, okay, stop, time for math, to a neurotypical brain, that's annoying.
Yeah.
To an autistic brain, that can feel physically painful. It's jarring.
It's like slamming on the brakes on the highway.
Good analogy. And the elopement in that moment is an avoidance strategy. They run away to preserve the activity or just to escape the demand.
And I assume that ties into the fourth trigger. Sensory overload.
Absolutely. This is the flight part of fight or flight. If a classroom gets too loud, the fluorescent lights are buzzing, there's a weird smell. To you or me, that might be a mild headache.
To an autistic brain.
It can feel like a physical assault. It hurts, so they're literally escaping pain. They will bolt from a noisy assembly hall to find quiet, even if that quiet is outside the building.
And the fifth one.
Escape from stress. This is more situational. Maybe a peer was mean, or they lost a toy. If they lack the emotional regulation skills to handle that big feeling, the instinct is just to physically remove themselves.
So we know the why. Let's talk about the when. Because as a parent or a teacher, you can't be at 100% red alert readiness 24/7.
You'll burn out. But we can absolutely predict this. The high-risk times map directly to those triggers. Transitions are number one, arrival, dismissal, going to the playground.
Unstructured time seems to be another common theme.
Recess and lunch are notorious. Less structure, more noise, fewer eyes per child. And obviously, anytime you're in a new environment or near those magnets, like a park with a lake.
But let's zoom in even closer. I'm standing in the living room. My child is there. What are the micro behaviors, the tells, that they are about to bolt?
The guide lists a few that every caregiver should memorize. The first is pacing. If you see a child walking back and forth, maybe wringing their hands, the energy is rising.
Like a pot boiling over.
Exactly. Then watch the eyes. Are they doing the check?
The check.
Glancing at the door. Then glancing at you to see if you're looking. Then glancing at the door again. They are calculating the route.
That implies a level of planning I think people might underestimate.
Never underestimate it. Another sign is a sudden change in verbalization. If a talkative child suddenly goes silent or stops answering their name, that withdrawal is often the calm before the storm.
So if I see the pacing, I catch the glance. What do I do? My instinct would be to yell, stop.
And that's a natural instinct, but it might be the wrong move. If the child is stressed, yelling adds to the noise. It adds to the threat. It might trigger the flight instantly.
What's the move?
De-escalate. Intervene by addressing the need, not the behavior. Say in a low voice, it looks like it's too loud in here. Let's go to your quiet corner. Offer a replacement. Hand them a sensory toy.
Break the loop.
Break that loop of stress leads to running by offering a safe off-ramp.
Okay, let's pivot to the hardware, the home front.
Yeah.
Because you can have all the empathy in the world, but sometimes you just need a locked door.
Physical barriers are non-negotiable. The sources are very clear. You need layers of security. Door and window alarms for a start.
The cheap, sticky ones from the hardware store.
Those work fine. It's just about the noise alerting you. And locks, high locks a child can't reach, or double-keyed deadbolts. But you have to balance that with fire safety, you know?
Right. Can't trap yourself in.
You have to keep the key nearby just out of reach. But there's a strategy for the home that I think is the hardest for parents emotionally. It's not about locks. It's about your neighbors.
I read this section. It suggests you need to go door to door.
You do. And it's awkward. You feel like you're labeling your child. You worry about judgment.
Yeah.
But you have to swallow that pride for safety.
So what do you say?
Keep it simple. Hi, I'm your neighbor. My son has autism. He has a tendency to wander. If you ever see him alone, he's not just playing. Please call me immediately.
It's creating a village.
And specifically, and this is life or death, ask about pools. If your neighbor has a pool, you need to have a very serious conversation about them keeping their gate locked. Give them a photo and your number.
The guide also mentioned social stories as a prevention tool. What is a social story?
It's a narrative tool used in special education. A short, simple story, often with pictures, written from the child's perspective. It explains what to do and why.
So it's not just a list of rules.
No, it provides the logic. Instead of just don't run,
yeah.
You read a story that says, when I am at home, I stay inside where it is safe. If I go outside alone, I might get lost. It builds the script into their brain.
Okay, let's move to school. This is where parents lose control. You put your child on a bus and you just hope.
And hope is not a strategy. You need paper. Legal paper.
Meaning?
If your child has a history of elopement, it needs to be written explicitly into their IEP, their individualized education program, or their 504 plan.
It can't just be a handshake with the teacher. Hey, keep an eye on him.
Absolutely not. Teachers get sick. Substitutes come in. If it's in the IEP, it is a legal requirement. It forces the school to allocate resources and follow specific protocols.
What kind of resources are we talking about?
It's logistics. It's a seating chart. You don't put the runner next to the open door. You seat them close to the teacher, away from the exit.
And what about managing those transitions, that inertia we talked about?
Visual schedules are key. You prep the brain. You don't just spring lunchtime on them. You have a schedule, you use a timer, in 5 minutes we go to lunch. You remove the element of surprise.
The notes mention creating a safety profile for the school. This sounded almost like a dossier.
It essentially is. It's a one-sheet document, photo, physical description. But the most important part is the triggers and calmers section.
Like he hates loud noises, he loves Thomas the Tank Engine.
Exactly. So a substitute sees a child getting agitated, they look at the sheet and see, oh, if I ask him about trains, he'll calm down. That's a game changer.
That is.
And here is a crucial insight. The safety profile needs to say, do not chase, if that is relevant.
Wait, do not chase. If a kid runs, you run after them. That's pure instinct.
It is, but for many autistic kids, if you chase them, it becomes a game. They look back, they see you running, and they run faster.
Oh, wow.
Or, on the flip side, they feel threatened by the pursuit, the adrenaline spikes, and they bolt blindly into traffic, just trying to get away from the person chasing them.
So, what is the protocol, then?
It's often called shadow and flank. You keep eyes on them, you move parallel to them, you try to get ahead and block the path, but you don't run directly at them from behind.
Trying to cut off the route without triggering that chase reflex.
Yes. And every staff member needs to know if that is the protocol for your child. It's so counterintuitive.
It really is.
Okay.
Like, let's talk about the worst case scenario. The lock fails, the teacher turns around, the child is gone.
You need an emergency action plan ready today. You can't be scrolling through your phone for a recent photo when the police are standing there. Have a digital packet ready to go.
With what?
Current photo, height, weight, and crucially, where would they go? Back to the triggers, check the pool, check the train tracks, search water first. That is the grim rule.
This brings us to the tech. I feel like every parent's first thought is, I'll just sew an AirTag into their coat.
And that is better than nothing, but the sources are very critical of relying solely on Bluetooth trackers like AirTags.
Why? I use one for my keys and it works great.
It comes down to how the tech works. An AirTag doesn't have its own GPS. It relies on pinging off other people's iPhones.
Right.
If your child wanders into a crowded mall, great. But what if they wander into the woods or an empty rail yard if there are no other iPhones around?
The AirTag goes dark. You have no signal.
Exactly. That is a terrifying gap in coverage.
So what's the alternative? The text highlights AngelSense as an example.
Right. And we're not selling the product, but we need to explain the category of assistive technology. Devices like that use cellular GPS. They have their own SIM card. They talk to satellites directly.
So it works anywhere there's cell service.
Correct. And it has features a luggage tag doesn't. One of the most debated but valuable features is the listen-in capability.
That feels a little invasive.
It's a heavy debate, but in a safety context. Imagine you get an alert your child has left school. You turn on the audio. Do you hear a teacher's voice? Or do you hear wind? Or do you hear traffic?
That context tells you how fast you need to move.
It tells you if they are safe or in immediate danger. Many also allow for two-way communication. And they have geofencing.
The invisible fence.
That's it. You set a zone school, home, you get an alert the moment the device crosses that line. You aren't constantly checking an app, wondering, are they okay? The app shouts at you when there's a problem.
So we've covered the psychology, the signs, the locks, the legal docs, the shadowing technique, the tech. It feels like a military operation.
It can feel overwhelming. And parents of elopers live in a state of high alert that's exhausting. But I think the real theme of all this is a shift in mindset.
How so?
We have to stop viewing elopement as a behavioral problem to be punished and start seeing it as a safety condition to be managed.
It's not about the child being bad.
Never. It's about the environment not fitting the child's needs in that moment. It also requires a shift from parenting in isolation to collaborative safety.
It really does take a village.
It does. Parents, teachers, neighbors, when everyone knows the plan, when everyone knows don't chase and to check the pool first, the risk doesn't disappear, but it drops.
Which leads to a really powerful thought to wrap up on. The goal isn't just to turn the house into a prison.
No. Prevention isn't just about higher locks. It's about understanding the child's perspective. When we identify the trigger, the why, we aren't just physically stopping them from running away.
We are fixing the problem that made them want to leave in the first place.
Right. We're helping them feel safe enough to stay.
Safe enough to stay. I love that.
That's the gold standard. Truly effective safety measures allow these kids to explore the world with confidence, not fear. And that's what we all want for them.
Well, that is a lot to digest. But hopefully it gives you a roadmap to make things a little safer and a little less scary. Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
Stay safe out there.